This is the Mile High Five podcast with Carl Jensen and Doug Cunnington. We have authentic conversations about the journey to Phi, health, happiness, and some very odd tangents. We interview Phi experts, side hustlers, people on their way to Phi, and those who have reached the other side. Join us every week, and if you want the show notes and links and all that other stuff, head over to milehighfi.com. Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. My name's Doug Cunnington, and today Carl is out. He recently was doing some research with Yale. I don't know if you guys are aware of that. It was about a vegetable urine study, something he's actually very passionate about, but it went so well that he's actually doing another one at Harvard. So I think he's moving up. I'm not so big on the Ivy League thing, but I think Harvard might be better than Yale. So congrats to Carl, but he's not here today, so I'm going solo, but I'm interviewing some friends of mine. Darren and Jolene are avid hikers, international travelers, and they retired early, but it wasn't even on their radar. So this is one of those cases of accidental fire, but not like flames. That actually sounds kind of dangerous. So we'll talk about how they found Phi and why they retired early. We'll go into the details of downsizing, international travel, healthcare, and South Dakota residency. They live off the 4% rule and don't plan on working anymore. And if I understand it right, they're overshooting their projections and they need to spend more money, which sounds like a kind of a silly problem, but I think I understand what they're talking about. So welcome to the show. How are you guys doing today?
Good. Wonderful. Thanks for having us, Doug.
And we met a few years ago at a Camp Phi, and like many of the Camp Phis, like a lot of people hit it off, and you guys are great. I've seen you a few times since then, and you've been doing some pretty cool stuff. Now, before we get into the Phi journey and all the details here, can you give us a quick intro, each of you, just like what you did in your previous career, and then we probably won't ever reference that again because that's way less interesting.
Yeah, so my name is Jolene, and I call myself a corporate dropout, class of 2020. Both Darren and I studied agronomy in college, and that's how we met. I worked for three different agriculture companies from 1999 until 2020.
All right.
Yeah, like Jolene said, we met in school and both followed our careers. It took us a couple of different places around the country. Really enjoyed our career for 20 years or so. And then things started to change the work just became a little bit less rewarding. And we kind of discovered that we were already Phi. We didn't really have that on our radar. And we were kind of got to looking around at what else there was to do, how we might reinvent our lives. And we discovered the Phi movement or fire movement and just, started listening to Choose Phi podcast and reading books and kind of went down that rabbit hole. It wasn't long after that Jolene retired and I stuck around for about one more year and also retired. So then in 2021, we were both free to travel.
Got it. And you said you had about a 20-year career where you were like, oh, this is pretty good. Yeah. But at some point, it wasn't anymore. Yeah. So talk about either, we'll go into both, but like discovering Phi and fire and also your dissatisfaction with the job. Mm-hmm. And either of you can start.
Yeah. So one of the reasons we found ourselves accidentally Phi in 2018 to 2020 was that we had both been in the same industry, working for the same company or for competitors of each other, a dual career family. So we had a fairly high savings rate, probably around 20% for each of us. Mm-hmm. We didn't keep records until 2018. Yeah, but we were able to go back through our IRS tax receipts and see that over 20 years, we entered our careers in a very difficult time for our industry. So we've just kept that up. So in a nutshell, we saved 20% and spent the rest. Yeah, so that's how we found ourselves accidentally find?
Yeah, I would add that so that we were both in the same industry, and the industry, agriculture, tends to go in a lot of cycles. So as commodity prices are up or down, companies tend to hire or let go. And so knowing that we were both in the same field, we always had that risk that either one or both of us could suddenly find ourselves looking for something else. So, and we both grew up in fairly frugal families. And so we didn't spend lavishly, but we always had that in the back of our mind, is that at any point, one or both of us could be looking for a different job. And so that was our reason for saving and investing, not so much for early retirement. So then when we got to the point where our industry was, again, going through some contraction and we kind of discovered the FIRE movement, we really reevaluated where we were financially. And we made the decision to really simplify our lives. So we had a large house and all the stuff to fill that. We took the opportunity during COVID to eliminate about 70-75% of that stuff and really kind of minimize our lifestyle. Mm-hmm. We went from two vehicles to one, from a big house to no house for about 9 months. We were fully nomadic. And then we've since purchased a small house that serves as a home base when we're not out exploring the world.
Okay. There's so much to get into. Yeah. All right. So I didn't forget anything, and we probably won't be able to cover everything. So quick follow-up question. So did you guys have a high income, would you say?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So high income, you save 20%, which is probably significant. Yeah. Do you have kids?
Nope.
No kids.
Okay. Which probably also helped us.
Okay. So good to know. So 20% isn't crazy, and you guys worked for 20 years. Yep. It sounds like, we'll get into this, but it sounds like you always invested and were like, okay, save for a rainy day, even at the very beginning. But you did have some like lifestyle creep in that mm-hmm. you probably continued saving 20% as your income went up, two cars, probably fancier, blah, blah, blah. Okay.
Yeah. We were always mindful when we moved several times for our careers, and that also helped us on the income side. And then when we've owned three homes during our working years, we were mindful to make sure that the mortgage was such that if only one of us had a position, that we'd be covered. So.
All right. And we will come back to downsizing in the 9 months of nomadic living. With your cost of living, were you in expensive places, cheaper places, middle of the road?
Yeah. So for the about the first half of our career, we were in Indianapolis area. So medium cost of living, I would say. And then we were in the Raleigh-Durham area. So not exactly a cheap area. Not the most expensive in the country, but certainly a higher cost of living.
One okay. thing that helped us with the purchase of the house in the Durham area was that we moved and built in 2009, when builders were desperate for anybody to have a house built. They wanted to keep their A teams during that time. So we got things like a free basement and extra bump out on the square footage. So, yeah.
Wow, that's pretty good. So you discovered FI. Do you remember like which one of you first found it? And if so, what was the path?
So in 2018, we were part of a large corporate divestment and acquisition. So as part of that process, we had to move our 401ks from Vanguard into Fidelity. So we sat down with the Fidelity office was down the street from our house. So went there, went through the transfer process to move things over. All of us that went to that other company had to do the same thing. And then it was that moment that the advisor, we were all assigned advisors, told us that, or asked us what our cost of living was. And they also asked, what did they ask?
Yeah, so the real question, that so they went through all the life goals and projections and stuff like that. And the last question she asked was, when do you want to retire? And we had never thought about this before at all. We had never discussed it. And we both blurted out the same number, which was 55. And we just thought that was a crazy number. And to both of our surprise, she replied, you know, punched a couple things in the computer, came back, said, oh, yeah, you could do that. Like, oh, wow.
So we went to the car and we're like, we should have asked for a smaller number.
Yeah, we should have shot lower. So that made us start thinking, that what is possible.
Okay.
And then on a vacation at the end of 2019, we have this story of like the last 10 years of our working careers. We would go to the Bahamas or another place in the Caribbean, rent a house for a week or 2 weeks, sometimes with friends. And I would read while Darren would go saltwater fishing. So end of 2019, I went to the Barnes & Noble and bought like 10 books on personal finance and living overseas, because I knew from my corporate travels that the basics of life cost less in most places that I traveled to. Yes, the luxuries were more expensive in a lot of places. Yeah, it was through reading one of those books about living overseas. We kept at the beginning of two books was this thing about fire. I'm like, what is fire? And then it was, yeah, we were in Cat Island, Bahamas, December of 2019. I'm like, I think we're one of these fire people. So.
Okay. And that was 2018, 2019 through those two little stories.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yep. It sounds like both of you were on board early on. I mean, you said 55 like at the same time, and then wanted to push the limit and pull it in. Were you basically, is that a good assumption? You guys were on the same page and you're like, hey, let's do this.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it was during that time we had a neighbor that listened to a Pat Flynn podcast. And so he also had friends who were financial advisors. And he's like, hey, if you don't want to just quit cold turkey, maybe you want to do some entrepreneurial things. So we started listening to the Pat Flynn podcast. And we even went to FlynnCon. Mm-hmm. So dabbled in affiliate marketing, and I found that easy and interesting, but I still didn't know I didn't need to do that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You're like, I just want to try. Yeah. That's funny. So I got started with all this stuff from listening to Smart Passive Income, which mm-hmm. I found in 2013. Mm-hmm. And then I started producing stuff. Yeah. Did you ever, and around that time, I had a lot of stuff around keyword research. Did you ever run across my material? On YouTube?
I don't remember. I actually...
Oh, you'd remember. It's really groundbreaking. No. No, it's okay.
I listened to the Authority Hackers.
Okay. Yeah, I know those guys.
A couple months and bought their basic program, and then I didn't really consume any more content, so I wasn't looking.
You were just moving. Okay. Yeah. Got it. Okay. Very good. When did you discover that you were financially independent and you could retire?
Yeah, I think it was around that, just after that vacation in Bahamas where Jolene had read so much about it. And I mean, we came back from that with a lot of energy and ambition to really dig into it. And up until that point, we had never really tracked our spending either. So, you know, we immediately signed up for Personal Capital, which is now Empower, to figure out what was our cost of living at that point.
We purchased the new retirement software.
And started running our own scenarios. Yeah, so it was right. We just went all in to try to figure out our own numbers. We also had another neighbor that was working for a financial institution and good driveway beer drinking buddy. And he's like, hey, give me your numbers. I'll run your scenarios as well. So between our Fidelity advisor, us running our own numbers, and our friend across the street, you know, we made the conclusion that, you know, this was all doable and we could start our exit plan.
Okay. And I know this is very interesting. Are you guys, because I know you're passionate about travel and hiking. Can we stick on this for just a few more minutes?
Sure.
Okay. Because a lot of people are in either potentially a similar situation or they're probably a couple of years behind. So this is very interesting. Okay. So you mentioned new retirement software. Is that just a specific like app that consumers can purchase to run through a simulation.
Yes. Yeah. And they also have fee-only advisors as well. So we, you can probably tell that you were the one that purchased the package.
But. Yeah. So the newretirement.com is the website, but it's often just referred to as New Retirement. They've got a free version that a lot of people use. We recommend the paid version. I forget what the pricing is. It's like $120 a year or so. Extremely useful. We go in and update our numbers and run new scenarios probably twice a year. Mm. So that's been really useful.
Okay. And I know I've never used that software, but I was going to say in us working with advisors and seeing the different mm-hmm. software, I know we're smart. We could probably put together a spreadsheet and do some things to essentially simulate that, but it's way harder and it's much easier to break something. And there's stuff that we don't know because we're not CPAs and other, mm-hmm. we're not statisticians that can run through this. We would make mistakes. So the software is like really valuable, or working with an advisor of some kind. And again, I know there's like free tools, but like there's issues with that. Not that they're not useful, but when you're like planning for a much longer time horizon, or you're like, I want to create another scenario, like what if we want to buy a new $50,000 car every 3 years? Like, where does that fall apart? Again, you can do it in a spreadsheet, but it's prone to mistakes.
You can. Yeah. We're not software people. We're not programmers. I would rather have somebody else already do that. And I think this tool and probably others out there that I'm not familiar with are extremely powerful. Like, you just make a simple change to your plan. Say, I want to do a bigger Roth conversion this year, or I want to postpone that big purchase of another car or another, a different house, whatever. It's so easy to plug that in. And the graphing capabilities are wonderful. So I'm a very visual person. So it is nice to see your cash flow or your investment accounts increase or decrease and with each of those different scenarios.
What was also very telling for us when we got the software and we started using it, and we had one session with one of their advisors, it's kind of like the Nectarine model that some folks might be familiar with, is that our high savings rate was in our 401ks and a little bit in Roths from our 20s when our income was lower. And so we could really see in that software that we were going to have a bigger tax burden in our 60s and 70s. We would be at an even higher tax rate than what we were as a dual career Fortune 500 company employees. And that was, and my father was also going through a similar situation,
really?
Seeing that what RMDs were and stuff.
Yeah.
So that was a coincidence, but also really gave us the confidence to leave, because we knew that there were different ways to access that money.
Mm-hmm.
And now we know there's even more, like the 72T. So
right. Okay. Again, you give me too much. All right. So we will come back to that too. So pretty quick question and answer for this. So you ran the simulation, you did it on your own, you had other advisors, you had qualified people. You're like, we are good. When was that? And then how long was it for you to quit, Jolene? Because you were the first off in 2020.
It was January. So January 2nd, we came back from our vacation. We had Netflix and it was really strange. We didn't watch it that much, but we just turned it on because it was cold outside. And we saw this Plane with Fire movie.
Okay.
And that really accelerated like meeting with advisor, et cetera. So that was January of 2020. I called my supervisor on April 1st of 2020 and essentially said, this is not an April Fool's Day joke. I'm done. I hung around for two more months because I had an employee retiring on May 31st of 2020. Hmm. And also, by having an employee that was retiring, I got full access as a manager to all the information that I needed about my own offboarding and what potential benefits that I would be missing out on, which at this new company was not that much. But the previous company, there were more significant and interesting golden handcuffs. Not with this new employer. So So gotcha. I spent those last 2 months like looking through and making sure everything was
okay.
Was fine on my severance.
So. All right. So just 3-4 months.
Yeah.
So okay. And then you were the next year.
Yeah. So during COVID, like, you know, everything was crazy, but we were in the process of downsizing. We sold our house very shortly after Jolene made that call and decision.
The day after, that's not a good retirement plan. That's your first day of retirement.
Just to sell a house.
Sell a house. The agent calls you at 7 a.m. and says you have a cash offer.
Yeah. So in that time, we moved down to the coast and, you know, enjoyed COVID at the beach. And I was working remotely and kind of waiting out for or waiting around for some subsequent incentives that typically pay, you know, most corporate short-term or long-term incentives pay out around the first of the year. So stuck around until those were in the bank. And then similarly, I made that same call.
Okay, cool. So fairly quick, and it sounds like because you were working from home, like it was a little, you weren't like on a plane every week or something more stressful. So
not during COVID. Prior to that, though,
yeah,
we were both traveling a pretty significant amount. At times, we were both 50 to 75% of the time traveling somewhere else.
Okay. And jumping back one more time, you didn't track your expenses in the past. Was it challenging? I mean, you used an app right away, but was it challenging in any way to track the expenses?
No, not at all. Once we signed up for Personal Capital, like I say, now it's Empower, but no, that was extremely easy.
Okay.
Yeah, we had just never done it.
Okay.
We were living comfortably off of our incomes. The bank accounts were steady. So we just didn't really feel the urge to go through the extra effort to track it. So yeah, it wasn't until we actually wanted to put some eyes on it that we signed up for it, but it was extremely easy.
Okay.
One thing that was also helpful with having new retirement, we found after we put things in Empower, our biggest expense was taxes by far. And we did make a lot of modifications to our lifestyle at the beginning. But it's kind of like Bill Yont says, like he didn't have to. Like when he went through his downsizing story and relocation story, by taking away some of that tax burden, the lifestyle didn't need to change. Like I think we overcorrected on our lifestyle.
So. All right. Any other surprises with the expenses?
Not too much. One thing that did stand out that, like I say, until we had started using tracking software to look at our expenses, we didn't realize how much we were paying Fidelity for managing those accounts.
And we caught that pretty early.
Like, right.
I think we're like 6 or 9 months of having assets under management. And like, whoa, next to taxes, like, oh, that's got to go too.
All right. So as we're probably wrapping up this section here, although there's so much to go to. So you guys were investing 20% for 20 years or so. Sounds like most of it was in a 401k, a little bit Roth in the beginning when you were below the limit and you could contribute to that. So when Elizabeth and I hit some point, I think it was about 10 years ago, 2013, 2014, we started tracking and we were like, I don't want to work until I'm 55 or 59 and a half. So we pretty much stopped contributing to 401ks and started doing a post-tax brokerage. We were ignorant of the different strategies, mm-hmm. basically. Mm-hmm. But in the long run, it's just like full flexibility, no hoops to jump through. Sure, from a tax perspective, it's not optimized, but from a flexibility perspective, it definitely is. So where were you guys at? Can you talk about like the percent of net worth in different buckets? And we'll go from there.
Going back to prior to us pulling the trigger to retire, we were just socking away as much as we could in 401k, maxing out Roth, but that was pretty limited. A little bit in brokerage account, but not really much. And then the equity in our house. So that was about it. And so I guess percentages, I think we had about 90% of our investable assets in pre-tax, so 401ks, about 10%, a little less than 10% in Roth and brokerage. and then equity in the house. So we had, I would say, limited flexibility compared to what you and Elizabeth have done. Part of our downsizing, though, selling that house in Durham, provided us a nice buffer in our brokerage account, which is what we're primarily living off of now. But yeah, coming back to what Jolene said earlier, we looked out and saw, how much that 401k was growing and potential RMDs down the road, and looking at how can we tap into that during the next 10 years. So prior to us, either of us reaching 59 and a half. Yeah, but we were very heavy 401k and Roth and not much in liquid assets.
And for people that don't know RMD, can you explain the concept?
Yeah, so it's required minimum distribution. So the IRS or the government says, once you hit a certain age, you have to start taking it out. They don't really care that you're taking out, but they want their taxes owed on that tax deferred income that you had. And so for us, that's 72 and a half, I believe. I don't know. It
changed recently.
Yeah, so. It's 20 some years from now. Mm-hmm. But if you leave that money sitting there and it continues to grow, at some point you will have to take it out and pay taxes on it. So there's ways to tap into that sooner through Roth conversion or 72T distributions.
Of which we're doing both.
Yeah. We're doing both of those to access those funds earlier.
Okay. And the Roth conversions are a more, I guess, common thing. So people are more aware and people could look it up. So we won't go into depth here. Mm-hmm. But what about the 72Ts? There's more discussion on it and it may be more, or it sounds more complex, but can you guys lay it out in your strategy for setting those up?
Yeah. So maybe we take a step back and say that in retirement, one of our goals is to maximize the 12% tax bracket. So for us, it's a married filing jointly tax bracket. And we want to fill that up with Roth conversions and 72Ts. So we both have 72Ts and we left ourselves some flexibility. And Darren can go into the mechanics of the 72T. But we left ourselves flexibility that if we needed to go on ACA at some point, we're currently not using ACA, that we our 72T ladders would not put us over those limits. And then year by year, we've been doing the amount of Roth conversions that we do is kind of depending on the market, but with the first focus being topping up the 12% tax bracket. But Darren went first on his 72T, so he can.
Yeah, so the 72T can be intimidating for folks. It is, I think, mostly because it is a fixed amount. So once somebody starts it, there's an opportunity to change it one time. I don't know. I think it's more intimidating because there's fewer people familiar with it than what it actually is. So setting one up is actually fairly straightforward, at least for us working through our Fidelity office. Mm-hmm. They have a simple form. You fill it out and use the calculations. I don't know. It's pretty straightforward. You have a few options or a few levers you can pull. One is you can subdivide part of your IRA out. So you don't have to start a 72T on your entire balance.
Actually, we recommend not doing
that. Yeah. So only determine how much of a 72T or distribution you want on an annual basis and partition off that amount into a separate IRA. And then I don't want you to pull the trigger. It's a minimum of 5 years or 59 and a half, whichever comes first, that you have to continue it.
Okay.
Another thing I think what makes it difficult for people is upfront finding within your custodian, if that's Fidelity or Schwab or Vanguard, someone in their office that is knowledgeable of the 72T. And when you're doing your first one, you don't know enough to know if you're writing by email or talking to someone who actually knows what they're talking about. So we have a friend, Eric. He was given the wrong form, I think, more than once. So yeah, the people within these large custodian providers don't have a lot of knowledge, because they really didn't make sense for a lot of people in our situation until 2022, when the interest rates started to increase. So it was not on our radar in 2020 because interest rates were so low.
Yeah, there's a portion of the calculation for the distribution amount that is based on current interest rate or what had happened 2020, I believe it was, is that you could have a minimum of a 5%, which is part of the calculation. What bottom line is that made it much more attractive. So you didn't have to have as much tied up into an IRA to get the amount of distribution that you might want. So prior to that, you'd have to have a bigger pot of money tied up to get a smaller amount of money out. So with that new calculation or the 5% minimum, then that gives you access to a bigger paycheck, essentially.
So meaning if you portioned off $100K,
correct,
you'd have to get $5,000 out each year at a minimum. Is that right? 5% of the total?
There's a few other things that go into the calculation, but that's similar.
Not financial advice. So, and let's go through like a real example, if you can, and just fill in numbers where it's like, okay, we want to do, say, we'll make it easy and say 10 years. So 10 years, and maybe we want to portion off like 100,000. So how might that look if you could estimate or fill in numbers as for entertainment purposes?
You could do like 300,000.
Yeah. So one of the factors that goes into this calculation is your age. And then I think it's also about whether you're, well, there's three different calculation methods.
You could just pick one.
Well, and I don't know the details of which ones, but they can each give you a different distribution amount. So typically somebody's going to choose, I think it's the amortization version or selection, but that allows you the greatest distribution. So let's say you want to get $20,000 a year, roughly, you would need to set aside $300, $350 into a separate IRA.
Okay. Got it. And that way, like you said, you would encourage someone to like just take a portion, and that way you're able to get a little bit out. You can, and I guess when you take those distributions, which are equal through the years, you pay taxes at whatever rate it would be. And like you said, you're trying to maximize the 12%. Okay. Correct.
The nice thing about it is that you, or I guess one of the main reasons people do it is to avoid the 10% early withdrawal fee penalty. So it gives you access to that without having that additional 10% cost.
Okay.
One of the other beauties about 72T is you can set up multiple ones. So let's say we've set our two up now, and 4 or 5 years from now, we decide we want to start another one. We can partition off some more, set up a second IRA or a third IRA, and begin distributions on that account as well.
Okay, got it. Currently, what's like the max income for the 12% bracket currently-ish?
With standard deduction and married filing jointly, it's 120-something.
Okay.
20, 24, 120.
So pretty good chunk, especially for two people. So, okay. And as we could do like 3 hours on it. So I'm trying to go faster. So you had a lot of money tied up. You just worked on the 72T. You sold your house to pull the equity out, and you had some money to live on for a few years, bridge the gap until you were able to do this stuff, which I think, I mean, you could have done the 72T or some other methods before, but a Roth conversion, you're kind of stuck for 5 years, right? Like you move the money in.
Correct.
And then you can't get that principal out for 5 years.
Correct.
So that's a bit of a hurdle. If you didn't sell your house, what would have happened? Like, was that one of your main options? Like, would you have been able to access the money? You just pay the 10% penalty. What would you have done? That's
a good question. Yeah, I don't know that we really thought through that because offloading the house was one of our first decisions.
We were both traveling 50, sometimes 70% of the time. And it was right after that same trip. We walked around the neighborhood and we saw a neighbor's house for sale. And it was during that walk, like we came back to the house, we're like, we're going to sell our house because they had appreciated so much.
Yeah. And we knew we wanted to change our lifestyle. We wanted to downsize. And so we didn't need that big house or to be paying the insurance and property taxes and
all
that,
the stuff
that kind
in
of
there.
A cost yeah. of living area.
Okay.
So that was kind of a no-brainer. But I guess back to your question is we could have begun 72T distributions at that time. I don't think we really even knew about them. And they weren't as attractive at that point either. So yeah, it would have been Roth conversion and mm-hmm. wait 5 years
gotcha.
Or tap into what we already had in our Roths, which wasn't attractive to us.
And another option, I do have a pension with a previous employer, so that could have been something we could have used as well. So.
Gotcha. And with this 72T, it's more attractive now because interest rates are higher. I get that.
Correct.
But it still would have been fine. You would have to move the money over. But by the way, is that still invested once you move it over? Or is
absolutely.
That like, okay,
yeah,
so it's
you
still
can
invested.
Still okay. manage the investments as aggressively or conservatively as you
okay.
like.
And just to make up a number, like to get the 20K, you mentioned 300K before. Maybe you would have to put in like 400 or 450.
Correct.
So it's just like a small, like again, more money is tied up in that bucket.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But you still get all your money.
Yes.
It's just...
Yeah.
Yeah. A lower percentage. Seems like a dumb rule. Like it's yeah. arbitrary, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't even matter. It's like you're paying the taxes on it, so
correct.
Who gives a shit?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't understand why it's completely arbitrary.
I don't
or there
know.
Must be some rule, but
I don't know the history
the
of
rule.
It. But yeah.
Okay. As we wrap up sort of the FI portion, then I promise we'll talk about travel. What about telling your family and friends? It sounds like it was pretty quick out of the blue. And then once you ran the numbers, simulations, thought about it, you were pretty quick to take action. So how has that gone over the last couple years or even initially?
Yeah, so my parents are in Northeast Kansas and they were part of the Back to the Land movement in the 1970s. So hippie adjacent. I think my dad said something to the effect of way to stick it to the man. Maybe those exact words. I don't know if it was in that vein. So.
Oh, he's like, I raised you right. Huh?
Okay. Yeah, and for my family, it was a little bit different. More of a shock and questioning, why are we doing this? And I think I even got a question about, is everything okay? Are you sick?
Your father did pass away fairly early.
Yeah, but it was just kind of out of the blue, like you say. So I think it came as more of a shock to people, because this isn't normal. You go to school, you have a great career, and most people wait around till 60, 62, 65, longer to retire. So it is very different than the normal script.
I think for me, one of my challenges was leaving during the lockdown of COVID. So I really didn't get to say goodbye to a lot of people that worked for me, because I'd worked with these people for 10 years. And since we were with the same employer at the time, I had to be more sleuthy about it. So I gave some spiel, like I was going to go into affiliate marketing or something. Yeah, so because I want to make sure that my leaving wouldn't inhibit a potential severance for him.
So. Oh, I see.
So yeah, 2020 was a great time to leave and fade into the bushes, like the famous Homer Simpson.
Okay, and you guys, it seemed like you knew what you were going to be doing, like once you stopped working.
Not really.
Okay.
No.
So how did that go? Let's talk about that and then transition into some of the travel stuff here.
Yeah, I think so. There's a lot of talk about retiring from something versus retiring to something. And I think both have their place. A lot of people argue that unless you're retiring to something, you'll just be lost wandering around aimlessly or have a lack of sense of purpose. And I would say for us, it was more just, I guess the retiring from something, we knew that, but the retiring to something, we just knew we wanted some adventure. We love travel. We love going to new places and experiencing the food, the culture. And we had a list of places we wanted to travel to. What that looked like over the next several years, we didn't really know. You know, we wanted to go walk the Camino de Santiago as a first step. Beyond that, we didn't really know.
We didn't really know where we wanted to live.
Yeah. So we just saw it as a big, wide open adventure and figured we'll see where it goes.
So I want to go back. Retiring from something, which let's say someone hates their job, so they're retiring from that, versus retiring to something, which we hear often at Camp Fives or other places. Yeah. And I was actually just talking to Elizabeth, and I think like that has lost its meaning for me, mm-hmm. because I've seen people retire and then like whatever, they get bored and they either go back to work or something like that. And I'm like, when someone says retire to something, what do they mean? Retire, because I'm like, if you don't have a specific job, then you're just, you know, you're retiring to your normal life. So can you, like, let's dig into that. Because I was talking to Elizabeth and I'm like, I think people shouldn't necessarily retire to something, because then they're going to set themselves up to like volunteer too much, or they're going to do some other thing too much because like they can't sit still or they can't figure out what to do otherwise.
And I think sometimes even if you don't hate your job, you can be so busy with the job, or if you have kids, busy with the job and or family, that you don't have time to stop and reflect about what that thing could be. So yeah, you could easily pick the wrong thing. I don't know. For us, it was more trying different things and not over analyzing it. And as soon as we found we didn't like a particular hobby or something wasn't as rewarding, is to make changes.
Yeah.
It's not really profound, but I can see what you're saying. If somebody selects something and if that doesn't work, they could have more heartache about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think for a lot of people, the retiring to something is a hobby they're passionate about, or I don't know, or retiring to help a family member, for example, something like that. But I don't know that it has to be quite so specific. Mm-hmm. I mean, it could just be, I want to retire to enjoy life, or adventure in our case. Or it could just be wide open. I think the beautiful thing about early retirement is we have a lot of time to explore, to do, you know, try out different hobbies, passions, volunteer opportunities, things like that. It's, you know, we can try something. If we don't like it, toss it aside and try something else. We don't have to worry about, we got to make a living doing this.
Right. Yeah, that does make sense. And I think I just, you know, I overreacted because I heard so many people say it. And then I see people that are like overly busy for like, no, I'm like, you control your own schedule now. You don't have any excuses. It's your fault. Okay. And I think, and I have tons of hobbies. Elizabeth is having no issue. She has a lot of hobbies, and like, mm-hmm. there's good community around here, and there's like so much going on that we have to be like selective on what we are doing.
Yeah. Same for us. We have not yet had a day that we're bored in 3-4 years. I mean, there's always something that we can do. In fact, we may often take on too many things.
And yeah.
So
it's easy to do. Yeah. Okay. So where have you traveled to? You're like, you like adventure. It sounds like you have done some international travel, but yeah, what was it like in the first, 6 months or whatever?
Yeah, so our first long trip in early retirement was 3 or 4 months after Darren quit. We had a property that we were renting and we let that lease go and went to Santiago, or to northern Spain, and walked the Camino de Santiago. That was about 40 days. Mm-hmm. And then we spent a couple weeks in the Algarve at that time, because we had also that's when we started consuming Fi content, and we had heard of people moving to Portugal and about the golden visa, etc. So that was our first big trip, and it was during that trip that we were like, we don't want to stop. Like, why? We kept like one bedroom, one studio apartment worth of stuff in storage, and we're like, why did we store all that stuff? What did we do for our second trip?
That's a great question. I don't know. The last 4 years have kind of been a whirlwind. I don't know. So we've traveled a lot in Europe, Caribbean a bit, Panama. Vieques, Puerto Rico,
Azores. And in all these places, we've met up with other early retired people through a group called Go With Less that was founded by a couple from this area. And yeah, other people that don't know anything about financial independence, but who are.
Yeah.
Yeah, so in general, I mean, we like warmer weather. So we like saltwater, islands, fishing, things like that. So we spent a fair amount of time in the Southern Caribbean. But yeah, I spent a month in the Azores, a month in Madeira. So those are all Portuguese islands. But yeah, the biggest part of our time, aside from Southern Caribbean, has been hiking through Europe. And I think we counted up yesterday that we've hiked through 9 countries in Western Europe, from Netherlands down to Italy and from France to Portugal.
Wow.
So our longest trip was walking from Hoek van Holland on the North Sea of the Netherlands to Aosta, Italy. And that was 70 days.
Wow. How many miles are you walking a day, or how much time on your feet?
Yeah, so we typically will average about 12 miles a day or 13 miles. So it really depends on the day to day. And that'll include some rest days. So we typically will include a rest day every 7 to 10 days. But it really depends on the region or, you know, what the cities are that we're going through. So at times we may go 2 weeks without a rest day because there's really not a place we want to stop. And then we may spend 3 or 4 days in a location. Yeah, but in total, I guess in our hiking, we've done about 2,500 miles over the last 3 years.
And what keeps us returning to Europe for hiking is that we're not tent campers. I think we went tent camping once, maybe right before we got married or right after we got married. We didn't like it. Yeah, so we're able to travel with 48-liter backpacks. So that's like the largest size you can get on an overhead bin. Mm-hmm. In most aircraft, sometimes we have to check it on these smaller regional flights. But yeah, we have everything with us. Packs weigh about 18 and then 20 pounds with water. But we like that there's a lot of marked trails, and there's lodging typically every 5 to 25 kilometers.
Wow, that is
so
nice.
So you're essentially like slack packing from village to village. And in these villages, it just depends. Some of them are quite small, 20 people. The medium is like 1,500 people. The accommodations that are available in each village or city are different. You can be sleeping in like what we sleep in at Camp 5 is fairly typical of what you'll find along these routes. But there's 4-star hotels and, you know, convents where things are very basic.
Yeah,
I think one of the things that keeps us coming back to Europe or going back to Europe for these hikes is, I mean, the history is amazing. I mean, we're walking on stones that the Romans laid or, you know, seeing churches from 1,000 years ago and so forth. So the history is just extremely rich. And we love food. We love experiencing all the different cuisines. But you meet some amazing people. Like most normal people don't just take a backpack and go walk for 30 days.
Yeah.
So you just meet some extremely interesting people.
Do you have any examples?
On our first hike, we met a high-level executive from Microsoft who, very similar story, quit about the same time I did, that he had taken an 18-month leave of absence to donate a kidney to a coworker. And it was during, I think he had gotten divorced right before that. He had a lot of time for reflection. It was like, after I heal from giving my colleague and coworker of 20-some years my kidney, he sold everything and put his art in his car and parked it at the Seattle airport, and he was out walking the Camino. Yeah. So he was pretty cool.
That is crazy. With one kidney. Damn. And I take it, it's fully flexible. So if you're like, oh, actually, I like this town a little bit more, you're like, oh, why don't we stick around here? And you don't have to make like reservations in advance and you could just kind of play it by ear each day?
You can. We're planners. We we have all of our reservations before we take off on a hike.
But we make them cancelable, so because we do have exactly that situation pop up. Okay.
Yeah, so we do try to include some flexibility should things change, you know, the weather changes or whatever happens, contingencies in case somebody gets hurt or whatever. But we do have all of our, we have plans set.
That's it. A plan for a bed.
Yeah. Okay. But there are many people out there that have no reservation when they wake up in the morning and they walk as far as they can in the day or want to walk that day, and then they find a room. A lot of people will book just the day or two before. Mm. So it's flexible.
Okay. And I can see if you booked ahead and then your plans change, then you can cancel, but then you have a cascading impact, and that's kind of a pain in the ass,
exactly.
Right? Okay.
Yeah. Another thing we like about the thru hiking is it's kind of like the evenings at Camp Fi, where you will meet people where you're staying that have hiked part of the day with you, or maybe you just see them at the end of the day. And yes, it's more relaxing to hang out in the evening when you know that your next bed is, you know, 15 or 25 kilometers away. And the folks that don't book ahead, they're often on the phone in the corner, so they frantically try to make phone calls for accommodations, and so they miss out on some of the community. But we understand people are doing these hikes for different reasons. Yeah.
Okay. And so that means you guys have averaged whatever, like 20 to 30,000 steps a day while you're hiking, mm-hmm.
When we're hiking, we're probably averaging about 30,000. So yeah, some days we'll even top 40,000 steps in a day, but yeah, 20,000 step would be probably a short day.
Okay.
And so I think you had asked about the time. So at a minimum, we're usually hiking about 4 hours, and we've gone as long as, I think, 9 hours on a kind of a rougher day. yeah, but usually we're around that 6 hours a day.
Okay. Pretty comfortable. And then it allows you to eat lots of food.
you can eat and drink just about anything you want and not feel guilty about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Any highlight meals or anything like that you like both specifically remember?
We happened to be in Logroño, Spain at the beginning of their wine festival and a couple of years ago. And we just went, you know, tapas bar to tapas bar, and probably one of the most interesting was pig snout. It was actually really delicious.
Oh, really?
You could see the hairs of the pig snout.
I don't want to see that, but yeah. Is it just braised or something like that?
Fried.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, well, you can't go wrong. Right.
And then in Italy, that was like 2 months, 3 months ago, mm-hmm. we had pickled cow udders.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Which if you've eaten a hot dog,
you've probably had it already.
Had cow udders. So,
yeah. But no, there's some amazing food. And probably our favorite route was through southern France. So on the Via Podiensis, which is from Le Puy-en-Velay near Lyon down to Spain. It was just a amazing, hearty, meat, potato, vegetable-based foods. You know, not French pretentious or mm-hmm. high, you know, a fancy decoration or anything, but just solid, delicious, fresh ingredients. It was amazing.
Mm. Yeah. It's also some of the warmest and friendliest people were on that route as far as hosts. They have very simple cuisine made from their gardens or from their neighbor's gardens. And yeah, very small villages. You're walking by buildings that are 1,000 years old, and yeah, it's quite rural. So beautiful landscapes, but people often ask us where our favorite places, and for me, it's southern France.
Nice. Well, we do have a sponsor, Ghostbed, and before we get to downsizing and the 4% rule, let's talk about sleep. And you mentioned something before about you tried like backpacking tent camping, and I don't sleep well. Like I have camped in the past, and maybe when I was younger, I slept a little bit better. But even when I've like upgraded a mattress and stuff like that, it's still no good. So I'm curious, like you guys are going from like different place, night overnight. How do you sleep in those varying accommodations?
Fairly well. I guess we've kind of gotten used to it, partly through our years of traveling for work. A lot of it really depends on the bed and pillow. And we've had some fairly uncomfortable beds along our routes. Those nights have not been so good. But for the most part, I'd say we sleep pretty well when we're traveling.
One key is everybody that does this long distance through hiking takes one or two things with them that are luxury items. And my two items are a toddler feather pillow. So it's like $80 with a duck down pillow, and it packs very nicely. And the other is a yoga stretching strap, because if you don't stretch yourself out really well before you go to bed, that can also cause some tension if you're not limber when you go to bed.
But I'm pretty sure we haven't come across a ghost bed on our hikes.
Probably not. And how about a haunted place? Have you had any haunted places? And
we've stayed in several monasteries and convents, and I think one of them was.
We're the only people.
Yeah.
Several times.
Yeah. Oh, wow. There was a old convent. Even the person working there left at night, and we were the only two people in this 13th century convent. We didn't experience the ghost, but I think they said there was one there.
Yeah, and there was a place in Italy this year. The village had maybe 40 people, had a gas station, because there were no other villages big enough to have a gas station. We were the only ones there. We were like the first guests of the season, and we stayed in a monk's room where he had drawn. They think this was in 1350. He had written in pencil, and like a colored pencils, I guess, of the scenery of outside. And we're staying in that room. Like, that's kind of interesting to stay in a room where someone drew on the wall 700 years ago. And it's just chilling in the room. You know, there's no, like, big protection. Everybody respects it. So, yeah.
Wow.
And I think it was, like, $40 a night or something.
Yeah, the pillow is a big deal. And Ghost Bed does have pillows as well as mattresses. And they have bed frames, all the accessories you need to sleep. They've been in business for 20 plus years. They have over 60,000 five-star reviews and cooling technology. So they have like a layer of like cooling something or other. I know in the pillow it's like a sort of a gel top, which is nice. And yeah, pillows are big. Like I have started, if there's space, to like travel with a pillow. Like I brought one down to Camp Fi just because sometimes, I don't know, it feels like a blanket folded in half twice, and it's like the worst pillow ever. Not necessarily a Camp Fi, but like, you know, some motels are like that, or hotels. So you could save 50% at Ghostbed. You can go to ghostbed.com/milehighfi or use milehighfi as the coupon code for 50% off. And they do have 101 night at home sleep trial. So you could check out a mattress if you want to. Let's move to downsizing, and we're still good on time, but we'll make sure we kind of punch through this. So you had this big house. You guys realized, hey, let's sell it. Let's get on the road. Was it hard downsizing by, I think you said, 70%? What were the challenges?
You could go first.
Yeah, so I think I become more emotionally attached to things than Jolene does. I think she's a bit ruthless when it comes to cutting stuff out of our lives, which is good. So for me, initially letting go was a little bit difficult. But once we got into the process, it was actually really refreshing to see space open up. You know, so
during the lockdown or during 2020 was a great time to sell stuff. A lot of stores were closed. Stuff was hard to come by. It was almost addictive. Like, how fast will this thing sell?
Yeah.
That was kind of fun. Yeah. And I also realized that the things we were selling, if we ever wanted to buy a place, or you could buy the thing back just from somebody else and maybe even in better shape.
Okay. And was there anything that you got rid of where later you were like, I wish I would have kept that one?
I think we had some tools that we got rid of that we've purchased back recently. This house that we purchased is 119 years old. So were there were some tools like, I don't think we'll need those.
Yeah, but I don't think I was emotionally attached to them so much. And like you said, now we've got a newer version of the same tool. So that's been fairly easy. Plus, we didn't have to move those tools across the country, you know, get rid of it down in North Carolina. And 4 years later, you know, buy it back in the new location.
Okay. Yeah, it seems like there's, I mean, very little downside to it. I need to get rid of some stuff. I've accumulated some things or, you know, moved things across the country and then realized, oh yeah, I could just buy a new one of those if I happen to need it again, but chances are you won't. But I was definitely, you know, what I mean, maybe with like frugal-ish parents or like, you don't want to waste things. You're like, there's still value in this, whatever it is, whether it's a tool or something more like a household item. You're like, I don't want to throw that thing out, even though it's probably only worth like $5 or so. And you could buy a new one if you ever need it again. It's just hard to like get rid of something with value. Did you guys donate a lot of stuff or was it mostly selling?
We kind of came up with a rule, if the thing didn't sell within 30 days, then we took it to a donation center.
Or if it wasn't worth the amount of money. So I think early on we set a threshold, like if it's not worth $20, they're not going to sell for $20. It's not worth the time listing it on Facebook or eBay or whatever we were doing. And the deeper we got into that, that dollar amount kept going up.
So
realized we want to get rid of stuff. And so it's really not worth the time to mess with the cheaper things.
Totally makes sense. Yeah. And I could imagine it creeping up as you're like, okay, I don't want to deal with this hassle. Like, you now you know how much of a hassle it is.
And I think, so it was after that though, but as we now look at bringing something else back in, like a new purchase, we kind of follow Michael Easter's slogan of gear, not stuff. So it has to serve a purpose. So when we look at buying anything now, we kind of have a saying that we joke about, if it's not something, if it's, you can't eat it, drink it, or smoke it, we don't want it. But that's not completely true, because we do buy some tools for home renovations or new hiking gear, whatever. So, but those have to fall under the gear, like it has to serve a purpose in our life.
Yeah. Okay.
Or consumable.
Yeah. Or consumable.
Any other tips on downsizing for people that are thinking, hey, I have too much stuff?
I think it would be identify a storage place that has temperature control and think about maintaining the stuff that you really want to, that would maybe go into a one-bedroom apartment or could be a tiny home or a small home. That way, as you're going through the culling process, you can start to put some things in that storage unit. For me, it was art, wine, things like that, that I was like, okay, I'm going to use this whenever we're done with this nomadic phase. That way you have a goal, like there's only so much you can stick in a 8x8 storage unit. And pick a higher end storage unit. Don't pick the one that's like 10 miles out of town and with no temperature control, because everything in there will become a crispy critter. So.
Yeah, I think the thing I would say would be recognize that everything deteriorates or becomes obsolete. So,
including
us. Yeah. But I mean, if it's plastic, eventually that plastic's going to get brittle, faded, whatever. If it's an electronic, I mean, 5 years from now, is it really going to be useful? I mean, it's probably going to be outdated, like our phones or computer or anything like that. I guess the realization that everything ages, whether you're hanging on to it or not. So think about further down the road how useful that item may be.
And the other thing, with a lot of personal items we took photos of before we gave them away or sold, that they were already starting to get old. And so we have a photo of that. And then we had a fair number of like albums and things. So while he was still working remotely, I would put on some nice music and then just start, got a nice scanner, scanned a bunch of stuff, saved it in the cloud and on a hard drive, and then, like, it's in two places. And it was easy to part with that stuff knowing that it's backed up somewhere, because we've not ever printed any photos since like 2009, probably. So we're like, there's no reason that we need to keep these physical things if we're not even haven't printed anything for 15 years.
Anything else with downsizing before we move on?
I think when you're doing it in midlife, people will think that you're crazy. Hmm. I think we're Gen Xers, so we also don't have as much attachment to stuff, I think, as a generation compared to older generations, because stuff has gotten less expensive. But people may ask, is there something wrong? Because we could go on for another hour on another topic, which is the first half of life and the second half of life. And so if you're entering what I would call like a second half of life mentality, and when you're in your 40s, people might look at you weird because a lot of people are still on the accumulation phase. And for us, our accumulation is on activities and adventures, mm-hmm. which you cannot see.
Right.
Yeah. So you'll look weird. I think the strangest thing that people thought we did was we went from two vehicles to one vehicle. So it's just because my car was sitting out in the driveway with the gathering bird shit in pine tar. So I was like, I need to sell that thing.
I've gone back and forth on selling my truck because I don't drive it very much. And I was chatting with our friend Mark Troutman, and he recently sold like an old beater truck. And I was like, yeah, I've thought about it. And after he told me, I was like, yeah, I probably should. Because I've thought about it for a couple of years, and I probably could have gotten more like during COVID. But the thing is, it's a V8 truck, which people could haul some stuff with. Yeah. But trucks are so expensive that there's some intrinsic value just to have like a truck that runs. And if I polish it up, it looks decent. You know, it's about 20 years old. So there's some stuff, but like not major. And I think Mark's truck had like a few significant things wrong. And he was like, yeah, the person just wanted to haul their boat or some other thing or whatever, snowmobiles or something like that. So, okay. So you guys are not working. You have no intention to work more. You are operating off the 4% rule, which is some people debate it in one direction or the other, but that doesn't really matter. The biggest thing is you guys are accumulating more. The markets are good right now. And you're in a spot where you're like, we need to probably spend more. RMDs are going to hit. Like you're doing everything. You're planning ahead by 15 years or so. But yeah, talk about a little bit of the 4% rule. If there was anything, I guess, challenging, just saying, hey, we trust the 4% rule. We're not going to go in one direction or the other. And then we can move into the other stuff.
Yeah. So like you said, there's a lot of debate about is the 4% or should the 4% rule be 3 point something, or should it be 4 point something or 5? And who knows? I mean, depends on market returns over the next, whatever we've got, 50 years, 40 years, maybe. But that's our guiding light, or has been for the last 4 years. So that's kind of our benchmark. Try to maintain that. But at the same time, yeah, our accounts have continued to grow despite the 6 months of travel we do a year. Mm-hmm. So we feel like we're still in a great place. Recently, we started listening to Jim and Chris from the Retirement Planning and IRA show based here in Colorado. And they've got a little different approach that we're starting to really consider. Both Mark Troutman and our friend Kevin have used those guys for their plans, and I think we'll get on their wait list as well. But their approach is basically, in a nutshell, make sure your future self is taken care of. So determine what all of your future costs are, your base living costs, any long-term care needs you might have, additional aging costs, and build in some buffer. And the rest is for fun. So it's fun or experiences. It's spending above your basic needs, whether you spend that all in the first year or spread it out over the next 40 years. So I think that's the approach we're leaning towards at this point. So redefining, you know, just how we approach it. But I think it will still end up coming back to roughly a 4-5% withdrawal rate. Because the idea is that we don't want to get to our 70s or 80s and then have a pile of money left and have regrets. So we're looking at like any money left over is life unspent.
And I think you had mentioned earlier, Doug, that perhaps a lot of people listen to the podcast or a year or two before launching, or they've just launched. And so I would say live with the 4% rule your first year or two, just so you get through some of those hurdles of drawing down, either if that's even like drawing down your cash pile or just getting the mechanics set up, and you live with it a little bit. And then you, depending on how the markets are going, you kind of see how that is. And the second part is when you get closer to 50, then things like Social Security, and if you have a pension, those become more real and tangible because they're not out there a ways. So add those into, don't leave them out of your calculation as you cross the 50-year mark. So, yeah.
When you started tracking your expenses, you just had a snapshot. Conceivably, you checked it for a quarter or 6 months or whatever to make sure you captured any infrequent costs. Mm-hmm. When you retire, your expenses often change. And one thing that I baked into one simulation before we talked to some advisors was like, okay, what if instead of spending, I'll make up numbers, instead of spending like 80K, which we have historically, what if we spend 125 and like do a bunch of shit and like for the first 5 years and go from there? But for you guys, like you did a couple, like you downsized, but you also like changed your lifestyle, which basically resets everything. And the reality is like, we don't know what our expenses are going to be in like 5 or 10 years, even if we can run through the simulations. I think that's one of the flaws when people argue about the 4% rule, because like there's too many assumptions for you to, I mean, we can't predict the weather. Like, it's just a fucking guess. Oh, yeah. So it's like, it gets you in the right ballpark. So how did you guys change your expenses knowing it was going to be completely different?
Yeah. So I think, we changed quite a lot. But going into early retirement, this new lifestyle, we really didn't know what it would cost. I mean, you think about what a vacation used to cost when we were working. It's like, well, that's X thousands of dollars and we want to travel half the year or even full time at the time we were doing this, like, wow, that's going to be a lot. But we knew that slow traveling would cost a lot less, right? So you can rent most places we go, you can rent a house, apartment, whatever for a month for usually the cost of a week. And so we knew if we slowed it down, it would cost less than what we had experienced in the past. What that was going to cost us, we really didn't know. We kind of had a guess. So I think I kind of, metaphorically held my breath for the first year until we got a full year's worth of travel under our belt and we could see what it cost. And like, well, okay, that wasn't so bad. And I think even going into the second year, Julian was extremely comfortable. I was still a little bit hesitant. I was like, okay, well, was that just a 1 year blip? And
then the market started to go down.
Right. And then the market's going down. Yeah, and I'm like, oh no.
But I'm like, yes, this is when we want to do those Roth conversion things these people.
Yeah, it was an opportunity. But I'd say it took us, or took me, a full 2 years of travel and our new lifestyle to get comfortable with what our spend would be. And now it's been about the same for 3 years running.
Okay. Was it more or less than what you were spending in the last couple of years, like in the big house? And
it's less by, I don't know, 40% less than
what's crazy. 40% less, and you're doing like awesome stuff constantly.
Yeah.
I think one expense that changed a lot is we were eating out a lot because we were traveling for our company jobs. So we got more fit. Yeah, we cook most of our meals in, especially when we're in the U.S. We eat out more when we're traveling in Europe or in the Caribbean. That was one expense that changed quite a bit. But we also started buying nicer and healthier foods, cooking. But
we eliminated most of our house insurance.
Taxes.
I don't know, what was it?
Our taxes dropped. House taxes dropped 90%.
Yeah, we went from $7,000 or $8,000 a year house property taxes to very little. I mean, and cut out one vehicle. So, I mean, we cut a lot of things out that were the big ticket items.
Our health insurance mostly stayed the same because both of us being at the same employer, they had a policy that if couples were at an employer, you paid the individual rate. So our premiums haven't changed too much in the past 4 years. And we've done ACA, and we've done an expat plan that covered us in the U.S. for half the year and overseas half the year. And now we're doing a Farm Bureau health plan that I learned from a couple other people that blog more or do YouTube in the traditional retirement space or the age 55 retirement space. Mm-hmm.
Can you give us the real cost if you're comfortable sharing for the healthcare?
Yeah, so right now we're just under $500 a month for the two of us. When we were doing the global expat program, it would have been cheaper if we just totally stayed out of the U.S. or if we were only in the U.S. for like 1 month, but we wanted to be here longer than a month at a time or per year. And so I think we were spending $600-something a month for those plans.
Yeah, and those also included repatriation from and like helicopter rescue or something. Mm. Yeah, because it was still, you know, COVID was still a bigger thing then. So, yeah, we had to look more.
Carefully considered that.
So you're only paying $500 for both of you now? Because we're paying like eight something. So we'll talk about it later. Yeah. But just for the real cost for people. Yeah. Okay. Oh, anything?
I was just going to say when we first retired and gave up our jobs, we did do ACA for a bit. If we were to purchase that same insurance off the marketplace, it was a little over $1,000.
Okay, makes sense.
What, $1,100 or $1,200? And then, of course, ACA subsidy helped with that.
Okay, got it. And we're not getting any subsidy at this point.
One last thing on the healthcare piece. One thing we've learned fairly recently by being back in the U.S. a little bit more, there's a program called MD Save that folks can check out. So if you're a doctor, if you're on a high deductible healthcare plan, which is what we have, that let's say if you need an annual mammogram or your colonoscopy, you can get the code from your provider and then shop various providers in your area and check if that provider is in your health plan. But you can save hundreds of dollars by having the same service done at one of many local health facilities. So that's one thing that, because we're on the high deductible plan, we don't have plans to, we've had significant medical expenses, but we haven't both ever blown past our deductibles. Mm-mm. In 1 year. So that's one way to manage expenses on a high deductible plan, even if you're still employed and are using a high deductible.
And even aside from MD Save, you can also get a cash discount. So if you just know that you're going to end up paying it, you can approach your healthcare provider and just say, hey, well, if I'm going to be paying for this, can you give me a cash discount? And, okay. And many of them will.
So we don't have dental or vision insurance because we found providers that provide a cash discount.
Okay. Very good. And making sure we're covering everything that I claimed that we were going to cover in the beginning. And we wrap up. Again, we could talk and talk and talk, but we did mention the South Dakota residency. Can you explain what that is, why, what the advantages are?
There's several states that have no state income tax. Three of them make it are probably the easiest for setting up your domicile, that being South Dakota, Texas, and Florida. And this is really more applicable maybe to the RVing crowd, people who buy an RV and travel the country or the continent. But it also works if you're nomadic or semi-nomadic with a backpack or a suitcase. And for us, we consider ourselves semi-nomadic. So we have a home base in the center of the U.S., but we're there less than half of the year. And so we have the opportunity to set up our domicile wherever we want. South Dakota works really well for that. They make it extremely easy to set up your domicile, get your driver's license there. And so we are technically South Dakota residents.
Okay.
So that means we pay no state income tax, and we, by staying outside of the state that we have a farm and a house in more than 6 months. So we also check with, if you're going to be living in a state in the U.S., check with a tax expert in that area to make sure that they're not, that you don't fall into a dual taxation situation. And another good thing about South Dakota is you only have to go there once every 5 years, or check your driver's license, because depending on what month you're in, you might have to go like once every 4.5 years. Yeah, so you only have to go up there once per year for 24 hours. And it's very, we do a lot of DIY stuff, but it's very helpful to pay one of these, we use escapees, but one of these companies that are founded by lawyers, and they'll actually talk to you before you pay a dollar through, like, have you thought of everything before you commit to making a domicile? So yeah, as a DIYer, the two things I recommend people involve other people with is domicile setup and health insurance shopping. And for us, that is an annual evaluation. So kind of like the stories you hear, okay, I retire to something, I get picking health insurance. Encourage people to shop that every year. And so the first year or two, use a broker. I think a lot of people don't realize that. The broker doesn't make any, you don't pay more because you're using the broker system. Mm-hmm. So they get the affiliate commission.
Right.
There may be a soft sell for some car insurance or something. But
yeah,
they're very typically very knowledgeable. And if you don't like the first one, find another one.
Yeah.
I think regarding the setting up a domicile in another state, that works for people who are on the move, RVers or nomads. Probably not for somebody who's still earning a paycheck in a given state. I mean, maybe that works for somebody who can be truly remote. But if you have an office in another state and that's where your check is coming from, I think you'd have a much harder time arguing with that state why you don't owe state income tax.
Right. Makes sense. So you just have to move to Rapid City or Sioux Falls or whatever. It's a fine state.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. I think we covered everything. Is there anything else that I forgot to ask that you want to tell us about?
I don't know. I would just encourage people to really think about their situation. And if you're on the fence about taking the plunge into early retirement, go over your numbers, think about your purpose in life or what you want to do with your days, but don't hesitate. I would say the one thing that really has been reassuring to us is finding the FI community and meeting other people who are doing this. Prior to us pulling the trigger, we had never met anybody who retired early. I think the earliest I ever saw somebody actually leave was like 55, and that was just because they had an older spouse who had already retired traditionally. And then we went to economy, and we actually saw real live people who had retired or were in the process of retiring. And then since that point, we've gotten involved with Camp FIs and have become friends. And that's some of our biggest social network now is the folks from Camp FI.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, it's been a pleasure hearing your story. Is there anywhere that people can follow you? If not, that is fine. But if I don't know if you have somewhere you want to share.
Yeah, we have a blog. We just post sporadically. It's Dare to Draw Down. One of the main reasons I set that site up, we got asked the question a lot, like, how do we secure our house if we're traveling for 6 weeks or so? So just a laundry list of ways to make sure that your house isn't going to fall apart while you're overseas, what kind of things we carry in our backpacks, so all the things we were getting lots of questions on. I'm trying to think of other
things. Well, and even how we plan our hiking trip. Yeah. So we've got a fair number of articles about that we would frequently get questions about.
Yeah. A couple of our first hikes, I kept a detailed list of what things cost just because in the evenings you don't have TV and people are talking. So I just took some notes. We would have questions of other people that have now done those similar trips. And so I could say, just read this on the website. But yeah, there's We just post like every few months or so.
Cool. We'll link up so people can find it, and you guys are avid attendees for Camp Fies and other stuff like that. So people should keep an eye out. If they do attend, you might be there.
Yep.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks.
Sounds good. Thanks, Doug.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington, the Balder host, and Carl Jensen is the cool, sexy one. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. Carl and I are just two guys with microphones that sit in my basement and talk. So we'll catch y'all next week. So funny thing you guys brought up. Can I talk about it?
Yeah.
Okay. So you guys just brought up like, oh, has Adam and Eve contacted you? And I was like, oh, it'd be great if we can get some toys around here. And just, I would set it on the Carl's table over there.
Yeah.
And he would just start playing with it. Cause like, do you see the fidget spinner?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just placed it over there and he couldn't keep his hands off it. So I'm pretty sure I could put anything over there and he would just get into it.
That'd be hilarious.
Yeah. All right. So you guys have been in town for like a couple days. Have you eaten out or done anything here in Longmont that might be interesting?
We live in north central Kansas, which is quite rural, and we're not close to a Costco. So we really enjoy seafood. And so when we go to Colorado Springs or to Longmont or even mid-sized cities in Kansas that have a Costco, we make sure we make a trip and stock up our freezer with seafood.
Yeah, our nearest Costco or any big shopping place like that is at least 2 hours away from us.
Yeah.
So,
We're lucky that we have a very nice grocery store in the small town where we live. It's about 700 people. So, if it's very beef focused, well, we're just good. beef, but you need more fish.
Yeah, the only other thing, we got together with Carl and a bunch of the five folks last night and hung out for a few hours, had a good time.
Nice. But, yeah, I missed it, obviously. I didn't see you there. I'm still recovering socially from the big weekend, caught up on my sleep and all that stuff. And I was like, I could go over there. It was pretty warm yesterday, too. So I was like, I don't know if I feel like it. Also, I tend to eat horribly, like on those trips.
Yeah.
And it was like right after, I got a million excuses, but it was right after my family was in town where I basically like ate anything I wanted the whole time. So I was like, all right, I really like, I know you can eat healthier, but often at a gathering like that, it's like not the healthiest. And there's usually dessert, like 50% is dessert.
And the snack room is always open.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. 24/7. So anyway, I missed out, but I was like, it sounds like it was a lot of the people that I saw in the previous week.
So. It was mostly a lot of the same folks. And yeah, I feel you on the time to get away from people. So after 3 days at Camp Fi, I mean, it was a wonderful experience. I love it. But as an introvert, by the time we got back to our room, I just crashed. It was middle of the afternoon. I just crashed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And a lot of times I end up not doing the full group activity. Mm-hmm. So I'll skip out on like maybe the breakout sessions and just like chat with a smaller group. This time I brought my chili pad and I slept way better. I like disappeared at night instead of like hanging out and drinking. Mm-hmm. So I didn't need to take a nap every single afternoon, which tends to happen. So anyway, after the fourth one, actually that was my fifth one, I finally learned like, oh, you can go to bed early. Mm-hmm. Like no one will even notice you're gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how many have you guys been to?
This was our third Camp Fi, and okay. All three of them have been in Colorado Springs.
Yeah. Gotcha. Do you have your sights set on any of the others?
We do. Yeah. So next year, we're actually going to three of them. One in Florida that happens to coincide with Jolene's milestone birthday. Yeah. So we'll have a big celebration down there. Then we will be back out here for Colorado Springs next summer. And there's another one coming up that Stephen is going to be announcing pretty shortly.
All right. So potentially by the time this one goes live, it'll already be out. I bet it will, most likely.
So, do you have an idea of the timing of this episode?
Probably like a month plus.
So yeah, he said weeks. We could go ahead and drop some hints.
Okay. So this is a good hint.
If you want to.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Cool.